If you're looking for something to read during these cold, wintry holidays, you might want to consider some suspense. Mary Higgins Clark and her daughter, Carol Higgins Clark, recently published their fifth holiday mystery novel called Dashing Through the Snow. Here's an excerpt.
Elvira, Willie close behind, was inside the store before Charlie could even think about opening the door for them. A cameraman and a young male reporter came rushing toward them.
"I'm Jonathan Tuttle from the BUZ Network," the reporter said excitedly. "I bet you two have the winning lottery ticket showing up in a limo and all." "Sorry to disappoint you," Elvira said. As the cameraman snapped off his light and the reporter lowered his mic, she added breezily, "But we did win $40 million in the lottery several years ago."
These two mystery writers, between them, have published 52 books and sold millions of copies worldwide. As part of our series, The Family Business, Mary and Carol Higgins Clark sat down with us in our New York bureau. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, I'm going to begin with Mary Higgins Clark. Did you, as a young girl, have role models for your dream of being a writer?
Well, I always loved to read suspense. My mother would call up, "Is the light out?" And I would say yes, but I was holding the book up to the streetlight because I just always had a book under my arm or under the pillow. It was just the way it was. But interestingly, my favorite was always the suspense writers. And from the time I was a kid, I was always trying to be the one who solved the mystery first. So I didn't realize it. I was teaching myself how to be a mystery writer.
Now, I have read something that I think is so funny, and that is that one of your first jobs, and you were quite young, was not as a writer, but you were working as a telephone operator in a hotel. And
oh, yes, in New York. I was 15 years old, and I just loved to listen in. Those were those old-fashioned boards. You know, it was Hotel Shelton, good afternoon. And then you would tap to see if room 358 was in. And if the board wasn't busy, you slipped out the master key, and then you could listen in.
You hate to be one of those people living in the hotel, but I suppose that's a good way to learn how people talk, especially listening in on a hotel room.
And Tennessee Williams lived there. He had the cheapest room in the place. It wasn't even a dollar a night. It was $30 for the month. And years later, when he became famous, and my first book, Where Are the Children, had been bought by Simon & Schuster, somebody who knew him said, "Let me give it to Tennessee and see if he'll give you a quote on it." And his comment about Where Are the Children, which is in its 75th printing right now, was, "I know a lot of people who can write better than that."
Well, was he interesting to listen into?
Oh, you know, it was the usual kind of gossipy thing. There was one lady who lived there who had pretty lively telephone conversations. And one time she said, "Don't say another word, that operator is listening in." And I said, "No, I'm not." And then quickly disconnected the call. And a minute later, the chief operator, "Who had Maggie Ryan?" And not me.
It wasn't until you were a mother of three, and this would have been 1956, when your first short story was actually published. But I gather you named the child born that year.
Yes,
after
Carol.
The heroine of that story. That's Carol, who's sitting with
my co-author, Carol. Yes. I had 11 short stories in the mail by the time that one sold. And the one that sold had been out 40 times until I found a little magazine in Chicago, Extension Magazine, and bought it for $100. And that was the beginning of my writing career.
Now, Carol, that short story is where you enter the picture, or the plot, I guess, both as a baby, but also as a potential future writer. Do you think you were born to be a writer?
Well, I always joke I felt the excitement in the womb when she got that acceptance letter. But I just grew up, my mother had the typewriter out, and then when I was in college and she had her first suspense novel coming out and had to get her second one into her agent, it was before computers, and she didn't know how she was going to get it retyped in time, so I did it. And that's really what got me into it, because I talked to her about the characters and the plot, and I did that for a number of her books, which was great for me to learn about how to write.
There have been a series of tragically young deaths in your family. Mary Higgins Clark, your father died when you were just 10 during the Depression, then your older brother when you were a teenager during World War II, your husband, and then, Carol, this would be your father when you, Carol,
yes,
were just a child. And on the same day, his own mother died too. Has that informed your writing?
I haven't used that as subject matter, but of course it shapes you. How can it not? With me, I always wanted to use humor in my books. That's what I like to do. My father had a great sense of humor.
It's the awareness of the fragility of life that has always been with me from the time my father died in his sleep. That has always made me utterly patient with the small things that go wrong in life.
When my father and grandmother were being waked, you know, there were two caskets there, and someone came up to my mother and said, "I'm sorry for your double trouble." So my mother almost cracked up right then and there, but my father would have appreciated it.
Well, because the Irish have an expression, "I'm sorry for your trouble." And for some reason, it annoyed Warren. He said, "You're not sorry for the trouble. You're sorry they're experiencing trouble." And that seemed to be a pet peeve of his. So when somebody came up, looked at the two caskets, and said to me, "I'm sorry for your double trouble," I started to laugh. And honest to God, I thought, "Oh, my Lord, Warren is going to sit up and look at this guy."
Is writing a part of the conversation when you get together as a family? Given that your plots are mysteries and suspense, I was just wondering if you, in your separate books, if you keep the plots to yourselves.
Oh,
no.
We wouldn't steal from each other. We actually fax each other pages as we're working on our separate books just to get feedback. Actually, one or two times we were talking about what each of us was working on, and there was something with art theft in both our books, but it was so different. It didn't matter.
And another time I was going to have a crooked Santa Claus, and you said, "You can't do that. I've got one in the book I'm working on."
That's right.
But we do talk our plots with each other because, you know, when you're writing and rewriting, you can get so close to it that it suddenly seems dull. You need fresh eyes you can count on to say, "That's fine. What are you worried about?"
Thank you both for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Renee. Thank you.
Mary Higgins Clark and her daughter Carol write suspense novels separately and team up to write a series of holiday mysteries, the latest, Dashing Through the Snow.
Author Melissa Bank was a darling of the literary world when her book, The Girl's Guide to Hunting and Fishing, was published in 1999. She says that writing does not come easily to her. It's difficult and wrenching, but when those tough bouts hit a writer, there's always reading to fall back on for inspiration. And this year, she read a particular book and can't stop talking about it. Here's her pick for our series where authors talk about books they love. You must read this.
Whenever people say they didn't like the main character of a book, they mean they didn't like the book. The main character has to be a friend? I don't get that. Here's a perfect example of a character you'd never be friends with, but you can't stop reading about. Her name is Olive Kittredge, and she's the main character of this book by Elizabeth Strout. Picture this: Olive on the day of her son's wedding. What is she doing? She's looking through her new daughter-in-law's closet. And she doesn't stop there. She takes a magic marker and draws a black line down the arm of a beige sweater. She steals a bra and one loafer. She imagines her new daughter-in-law saying, "I must be losing my mind." Here's a character who's as bad as you'd be if you let yourself, and that's partly what drives the book. You can't wait to see what she's going to do next. This is the story about people who live in a small town in Maine, people who might seem ordinary, but they're only as ordinary as we are. It might sound ordinary for a woman to find out her husband's cheating on her, but not if you're the woman and it's your husband. You feel that way in every story, I think because you're privy not only to the characters' private lives, but to their most intimate thoughts and to secrets they haven't told anyone. There's at least one secret in every story, and one life-changing moment. Maybe that's why this book delivers what you hardly ever get in a literary novel, suspense. Take the story that begins with this sentence: "An awful thing happened to the Kittredges on a chilly night in June." In my opinion, Olive Kittredge is a masterpiece, and what makes it a masterpiece is how it's done. The writing is so perfect you don't even notice it. The story is so vivid it's less like reading a story than experiencing it firsthand. Here's how real the characters are to me. While I was working on this essay, I caught myself withholding information about the characters to protect their privacy. I was writing about Olive's husband and his secret longing for another woman when I thought, well, I can't say that. Why? I imagine the whole town hearing about it on NPR. If I sound insane about this book, it's because I am insane about this book. I'm willing to do almost anything to get you to read it. Not because the book deserves to be read, though it does, but because if you're like me, Olive Kittredge is the book you're always looking for. A book that prevents you from going to sleep at a reasonable hour, that lifts you up and out of the subway. A book that gives you a double life to lead and changes the life you're in. Olive Kittredge is a book that will remind you of how much you love to read.
Melissa Bank is the author of The Girl's Guide to Hunting and Fishing and The Wonder Spot. She lives in New York City. You can find the whole list of You Must Read This at NPR.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I am Netta Ulaby. This week on NPR's podcast, Book Tour, we'll hear from Pulitzer Prize-winning opera composer John Adams as he reflects on a life spent making music.
The story of Mozart mesmerized me. I thought the idea of a young boy composing music not only was enchanting, but was worthy of emulating. I went home one afternoon and took a pad of blank notebook paper, a ruler, and a pencil out onto the hill behind our house. I drew a staff and started to write notes. It only took a minute to realize that what Mozart had done was far more complicated and evolved than what I could do.
To hear the entire reading and discussion, and to hear more authors of fiction and nonfiction reading from their work, visit npr.org/booktour.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand. Iranian professor and author Azar Nafisi wrote the best-selling memoir Reading Lolita in Tehran. She wrote about trying to teach under the conservative Islamic rules imposed after the 1979 revolution. She was eventually forced out of the University of Tehran. She then held private, secret classes. And one of the books she taught her small group of mainly female students was Nabokov's Lolita, a book about transgression, among other things. Azar Nafisi has a new memoir out now. It's called Things I've Been Silent About. Welcome back to Day to Day.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
Why did you decide to write another memoir?
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, I didn't decide. I was all against it, in fact. Uh-huh. I had it all planned that after I finished writing Reading Lolita in Tehran, I will write a book that I had in mind for a long time called Republic of Imagination, which was about the subversive role of imagination, you know, in terms of our political and social life. And then as I was writing the acknowledgments to Reading Lolita in Tehran, my mother died. And I had always been sort of obsessed with her and my own relationship with her, but her death threw me into a state of panic. And I started thinking about her and about our own relationship and how could I retrieve her in some way, now that she was forever gone. And then a year after my mother's death, in December 2004, my father died. And after that, memories kept leaping out, and and I was drawn to begin at that personal moment when I became conscious of them, and then put that within the historical context.
Now, your mother is a huge, huge part of your book. She dominates, really,
yes,
your book, and it sounds like she dominated your life
for a long time. Yes.
What was your relationship like with her when you were a child?
From the moment that I can remember, the relationship was a very paradoxical one. On one hand, she was very loving and attention-giving. On the other hand, she was also very domineering. I mentioned, I think, in my book that I said she was in the perfection business, mm-hmm. you know. And she wanted me especially, because I was the girl and I was the firstborn. She wanted me to be a perfect everything. There was no pleasing her ever. And I felt that she kept wanting to shape me according to the image she had of what she wanted to become.
You write a very, very poignant line I found in your book where you say simply, "I was perhaps her greatest disappointment." Now, that is quite something to yeah. say and quite something to feel, that you are your mother's greatest disappointment.
I felt that way, sometimes the way she looked at me. But, you know, writing this book, I also discovered her vulnerability, that despite her domineering personality, she suffered all her life from a lack, her own mother having died when she was so very young. Her first husband, with whom she was so much in love, on the first night of their wedding, discovering that he was going to die of a disease that he had never told her about before their wedding. And she always wanted to be a public woman, an independent woman, and that dream was never fulfilled. So I realized how much she tried to invest in me. And that put a great burden on me. But in some ways, she gave a lot in order for me to become independent and to fulfill her dream, in a sense. So finishing this book, I feel maybe I was not as much a disappointment as I sometimes feel I was.
And where was your father in this and all this? I mean, you write in your book that you were very, very close with him. And I'm just wondering, you have this very intense, tortured relationship with your mother. And where is your father?
In many ways, he was almost the exact opposite of her. He was very tender and very gentle. I mention in my book, and I still have that diary he wrote when I was about 4 years old, where he addresses it to me as his confidant. Obviously, at the age of four, I could not really play that role, but that is the role he cast for me, mm-hmm. you know, which was much slyer than my mother's, because my mother was upfront, but my father, by rallying me as his confidant, also made me complicit, sort of creating a front against mother. But also, he was the first person to tell me stories and to show me that other world of imagination where I could genuinely be free and in control. And so that part of the relationship with my father is what sort of has remained for me unblemished. And all his life, his dream was to have a happy family life, something that he never really fully achieved with my mother or even later. But that was his dream, and that was where he failed.
Well, and he was the mayor of Tehran for a little bit and was in prison for several years.
Yes. Both my parents were very politically conscious, and we come from a family where a great many of them were public figures, and my father was sort of a rising young man, and he became actually the youngest mayor of Tehran at the age of 42. And
this was under the Shah.
That was under the Shah. And that was at a very critical period when the Shah was implementing what his so-called reforms, the White Revolution, it became famous, known as. And that was the time when also they gave the rights to women to not only vote, but, you know, enter the parliament. And so my mother was one of the first women who went into the parliament. And my father was very, very much devoted to his work. He absolutely loved it. But he was a terrible politician. You know, he would not enter any form of compromise or speak the political language. And he was very proud of this sort of rebellious aspect of him. But he also paid a big price for it. He was in jail from the winter of 1963 until 1968. And that was a big price.
How did that affect you and your political consciousness or your sense of your place in Iran?
Well, my father's jail especially, but also the way my parents were, always made me feel politically suspicious of whoever was in power. And I think that I've kept that in a sense. And to be politically active, not in the sense of wanting to ever myself become part of any political group or clique, but there were certain values, certain principles that became very important. And I felt that that is the main thing, not to compromise those principles, not to be, as my father used to say, not to be ashamed of yourself. But it really, really, I think, changed my world forever. I could never, ever again trust anything. If my father, who one moment was one of the most popular mayors Tehran ever had. I was in Switzerland at the time, and, you know, we would see his pictures with General de Gaulle in Paris match, with the King of Denmark, with Chancellor of Germany, you know. So he seemed to be top of the world. And the next moment, almost, he would be in jail. If that could happen so easily, then I realized that anything could happen, and you cannot trust at least the political life.
Azar Nafizi, coming up, we continue our discussion. She talks about the sexual abuse she had been silent about and how that influenced her view of Nabokov's novel, Lolita.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.